Welcome back, everyone, to compiler construction. Last time we left off in the middle of bottom-up parsing, and therefore we started with a few helper constructions that ended up in a combination of several automata that were where one was piggybacking the other. So, if you remember correctly, there was this shift-reduce automaton. And this one was kind of the frame for everything we did in bottom-up parsing. This was the automaton that was connected to the input and had a push-down, and was in principle a simple push-down automaton that could do only two different things. One thing it could do was shifting particular symbols or terminals from the input onto its push down. And the other option it could do was if you told him that it should perform a reduce action, it would take away symbols from the push down and replace it with something that you told it. And with this simple construction, our goal was to do a rightmost derivation, a reverse rightmost derivation. When doing so, we could end up with an example like the one that I've prepared for you today. So there's this that what you see here is a rightmost derivation tree, which we try to process with reverse rightmost derivations using this shift-reduce parser. How does this work? Last time we tried to draw something like that manually. Now we can see the animation for that. So there's input. There's a push down, and to help you in imagining how the reverse rightmost derivations are reduced in this reduction tree, I've drawn you the conceptual reduction tree next to the whole thing. So how would the whole system work? There's two actions. There's for one shift, and that's what we're going to start with. We will shift the first token, that is this name, onto the push down. And following this these reverse rightmost derivations, the first action would be to actually take the thing that is on top of the push down and reduce according to this reverse rightmost derivations. You would have to reduce to f. So that's this part of the derivation tree that you've reached now. And now you have the F on the push down, and the input is reduced a little bit. So we can progress further with our reverse rightmost derivations. This would mean we have to reduce one step further. So we have replaced the F with a T. We can progress even further. This would mean we have to travel to the other side of this subtree, because we always have to reduce them before we can reduce the kind of parent subtree. So what we will have to come up is we will have to push those two symbols. That's what's going to happen here. And now, with our reverse rightmost derivations, we can once again tackle the push down and reduce it to something like this. And now I'm in the situation that I have only this little bit larger subtree left. I find this on the push down, and we can reduce it to T once again. So I'm progressing through this whole input, and conceptually through the whole rightmost derivation tree. There was last time a little bit of confusion whether this is actually a rightmost derivation or leftmost derivation, as we start from the left. But you always have to keep in mind that the whole thing is in reverse. So when I do reverse and start from the left, I'm actually doing the reverse of starting from left, so I'm starting to derive from the right. And if I do my whole animation backwards again, you will see that this is actually the case here, because I'm going backward. I will uncover the rightmost part first of each of these still to derive non-terminals. So yeah, that's what's happening here now. So it's actually a rightmost derivation that we tackle from behind. Okay. Anyway, what I was trying to show you with this is that that is actually the sequence of reductions that we want to achieve with our parser. But the question is now, as we don't know up till now what the derivation tree actually looks like, we can't use this one as a helper structure. So this one is not really there. So how can I kind of find the sequence of actions that will gonna lead me to such a derivation tree? And the only thing that we have for help is we can have a look, for example, in our pushdown. And it actually turns out that we have already seen one criterion for when we want to perform reductions, and that is if we find on our pushdown automaton that there is a right-hand side of our grammar, we will most likely want to reduce it to its left-hand side. So I will reduce this T times F to T, which is one of the rules of our grammar. So the tricky thing in this is that the stack is not always containing only a right-hand side, because in this situation, for example, what we want to achieve is we want to have a reduction from F to T, but actually we have something more complicated on the pushdown. And it turns out, when we look a little bit more closer to the whole thing, so yeah, the first thing that we realized is, well, there is something like we right-hand sides of rules on our stack, and we if we detect them, we want to replace them with its left-hand side. But it might also be the case that this right-hand side of a rule is not the only thing on the stack, but it is kind of the top of the stack. And before that, we will see that there's something else still lying around. And there's something else. What is that? That is actual remains of further of earlier attempts to do these derivations from the left. So if you look at this conceptual thing here, you see that we tried to do these reductions already for a few first sequences of symbols, but we couldn't finish with our whole reductions because there was still the right-hand side of this subtree, which is this one. No, that's which is this one, was still missing. We didn't have the appropriate right-hand side. So there's there's this part of the pushdown that is kind of remains of earlier attempts to do reductions. That is the general situations that we face on the pushdown that we have to deal with. And yeah, the idea to deal with this is to find some kind of mechanism that parses this stack content for situations where we want to do reductions, and also tell us which reductions it should do. And we had already spoken about which mechanism this is. This is this characteristic automaton. The question is now, how did we come from this situation to this characteristic automaton? That is what this pink arrow in the diagram is all about. You see, the kind of path I have to go inside of these remains in order to get to the handle which I want to reduce is always of a certain form, the one that we've seen before. Yeah, we could use that in order to get to the first idea. Well, at first there's things that are on the stack, and how can we navigate to them inside of this derivation tree is that we have to kind of follow the derivations. So what I had to do for that is I had to expand with the E, had to expand with the T, and had to expand with this T once again. So there's a lot of expansions going on. And while I did these expansions, I didn't do anything to the input or to the parser, so to say. This is these kind of epsilon transitions. And in order to analyze which reductions I wanted to do, I had to have a look at these framed things here. This is T, the star, and the F. And that is something I have to treat accordingly, and I have to parse them, I have to read them. So that is something that will end up with reading transitions. And the same goes for this situation, except that I also had to interpret some of these symbols in order to navigate through these remains here to get to this point. And how did I get this one? Well, I in one of the expansions that I did, I simply did a transition with one terminal that I had to actually read, so that was something that was not an epsilon transition. I also had to pass this symbol, which is also kind of something that lies on the stack, so I had to read it. And then in this production over here, I had to expand. This is something where there's something hanging below, so I didn't have to actually interpret it because it wouldn't show up on the pushdown, but instead I had to do a kind of epsilon transition again to reach this F, which I once again had to interpret somehow. And that is the intention that is behind this characteristic automaton here. When you check this, you will actually see that for the expansions we have these epsilon transitions, and for something that I had to interpret, I will have named transitions that consume something. And this automaton tries to do these derivation steps that we had in this derivation tree conceptually in the background. And in case that it reaches a state where it has passed a whole right-hand side of a rule, it will become a final state, as this will be our marker for here at this position. We will have found a complete right-hand side with some special context before. If you remember, we had the situation with an E plus F on the stack, on the one of the slides before. How could that happen? That happened by, there was one kind of attempt to find out that this kind of path was begun on the stack, but somehow in the middle, there was the situation that this T still was not found so far. So there's the epsilon that goes over here, which we also can consider in our automaton, where we find that there is an F transition. That is, so if we trace our route through the automaton, we will have gone the E, the plus, and the epsilon over to there, and the F into this state, where we will see that, this is a final state where we have a completed item. This tells us there's a reduction that we have to do, So we went from E plus F, we had to replace the F with the T, so we went to E plus T. And with that, we could kind of trace back through our automaton over here, where we were still standing with E plus T in mind. And now that we have actually verified that we have gone through this branch that was reading the F under the context of T, we will be able to continue with T and reach one another final state. And then, in the end, the very last transition that will be going on will be the one that that will be this one, where the S prime goes to E and the bullet is on the very right hand side, which means that we have treated all the derivations that were possible, and that also means that our reductions have reached have covered everything that was derivable. Okay, so that is the intention behind this characteristic automaton. Now, people were wondering what this might be. And that is just the same automaton that you've seen before. It is just gone through the measurements that we have seen during the scanner part that made the non-deterministic final automaton into a deterministic one. So there's no epsilon transitions anymore. It's just unique labels outgoing from every state in there. So this is the deterministic automaton in this case. So that is the general concept behind these automata. There's the actual framework, which is the shift reduce parser, which is a push down automaton. And on top of that sits a little small supplemental automaton, which is a finite automaton, has no pushdown for its computations, but it this one uses the pushdown of its parent automaton as input, and all it produces is hints to the shift reduce parser whether it should do reductions or shifts. That is everything that's happening here. So there was this way of determining the canonical LR0 automaton directly. We have done that last time, so I will uncover that once again. So that is the general proceeding that you need for LR0. Is there still any remaining question for that? So let's continue with new topics. So the first thing that we want to do today is with the measurements that we have found so far, we want to create an actual working parser. So we still have to specify how to assemble a parser from the components that we have created so far. And we have talked about this mechanism of one automaton parsing the stack of the other one. There's still one optimization that you can do, because in the setup that we have so far, it was necessary for the finite automaton, for this canonical automaton, it was necessary to read the whole pushdown of the shift reduce parser in every step that the computation was doing. That was something that is in principle a little bit redundant, because as you've seen before, when I was kind of sketching this way through the characteristic automaton, a lot of the work that we were doing in navigating through all these transitions has to be done once again, and a lot of the remains of the pushdown would not even change from one step to the other. It's just the top of the pushdown that would change. So the idea would be to save us a lot of work, and the way to save computations of finite automata is to actually keep the trace of the states of such an automaton. That means that you rather than stacking the input that you've read so far of the shift reduced parser's input, rather than storing these inputs and the intermediary symbols on the pushdown, you would instead directly feed this input into the canonical automaton, and then kind of try to introduce safety points in this canonical automaton of the parts of the computations that it has already done. And you can do this by just pushing the states that the canonical automaton has reached on your pushdown instead of the symbols that you've done before. So that is this optimization. What this means in more formal ways, kind of a specification, that is something that you can see here. So that is the formal specification of how the LR0 parser with the optimization that we have discussed so far actually does. So we have a small automaton, that is the canonical automaton, and it has certain components. The most important one is the transition function of this one, because we will rely on the states that this one will produce, because we need to push that on the pushdown of the shift reduced parser, and this in this case of the LR0 parser. So what are the steps that are done with this LR0 parser? Well, there is reductions and shifts going on. When do we do shift? Well, as you remember shift, what does a shift mean? You have as a state P on the top of the pushdown, which is now in this optimized version of this whole construction, is a state of the canonical automaton. So that is a kind of computation step in my canonical automaton. Then there's input A, and you remember the idea was to give the input directly to the canonical automaton in order to make it compute even more. So yeah, what you would do is you would let it compute and have a look at its outcome, and you would put this outcome also on the pushdown. So that's this kind of safe spots that you create for the computation of this canonical automaton, and you put all of those on the pushdown. You do that until you reach a situation where the latest computation of this canonical automaton, that is the one that you can see at the very top of the pushdown, when this one contains the item like this, which is a complete item, and that is the most relevant thing here. If you encounter a complete item in the state of the canonical automaton, what you do is you remove all the computation steps that led to completing this item away from the pushdown. So that is why the top of the pushdown is a little bit larger in this case. We have, if the right hand side of the item that is completed on the pushdown has m symbols, then we will also have m many computation states of the canonical automaton on the pushdown. And yeah, if I have completed this one, what I do is I say, okay, I've checked this branch of my derivation. I find it matches with the input, and now I have to take this one away and replace it with one place further in my derivation tree. How do I do that? I replace conceptually in the shift reduce automaton's view, I would replace the symbols that belong to the right hand side. In our LR0 parser, what I do is I remove all the computation that had to do with verifying this branch of my derivation tree and replace it with a computation state that assumes that I have passed this non-terminal. So that means that I have done a shift with a non-terminal symbol in the canonical automaton. Yes.
So if you want to run where the steps, the computation steps that led you to X1 for X1.
Yeah, so if you go back to the automaton, this is the most intuitive one, although it has not done all the joining of the epsilon things. These M many computation steps would be the ones that that go through one of these lines. So there's just this sequence of computation steps that corresponds to these items here, and that's just shifting the dot with the help of the consummation of all these symbols.
Do you think that there's something unrelated throughout this procedure?
There's something what?
Unrelated to this.
Yeah, but in this case, you would conceptually interpret the whole thing not with this within one of these lines, but you would interrupt the computation in some kind of emergency exit route through one of these epsilon transitions and be in a completely different right hand side and try to complete this one. And that is also why you chew away all the branches until you have still something to do. And that makes, in the end, creates a whole right-hand side of a computation.
But something is still left out. For example, if you take this path, you have with E, 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 and then you go back to T. So first row, second row, we just have that.
This one? Which one?
Downwards. No, the one where you are, the state where you are, upwards. So
upwards
third
is
column, on the third column.
This one?
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, this one?
So you go downwards. But then you still have the E and the plus there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you then go downwards and then you're back at one of these two states, which
yeah.
Exactly, you complete this path. So now you would take these states away.
Mm-hmm. E and plus still remains because they don't count into the length of it's the length of the right hand side. And if you, for example, succeeded in processing this one, you will have a length of 3, and we'll just remove these 3. Actually, it's because you don't count this one so far because it's not on this. Well, there might be off by one thing here, but actually, it would mean that you would take away all the computation parts that had to do with one right hand side. And yeah, that's just kind of retracing your way through this canonic, or in this case, characteristic automaton, to a path which you have not finished yet, and then go further with the additional information that you went, for example, through a T, and now you can put in the T because you have verified that it exists. So that's the idea. Okay. Good. So I think that this was the one. So that is the, in principle, the concept that would be behind that. So there was still one open thing, because although the canonical automaton would be deterministic. The thing that is not deterministic is this part, because there's still possibility that inside the canonical automaton's state there would be, for example, different completed items or completed items and non-completed items. So it would not be there's no unique telling. No telling of a unique solution for this situation. You could, for example, reduce with something that is smaller or something that is larger. It's still not, the LR0 does not provide you with more information on that. So that's a situation of that you have conflicts. And these conflicts have names. There's the reduced conflict. That means that in one of the states that are on top of your pushdown, in one of these states, you have two different completed items, so you still don't know what to do in these situations. The other thing that might happen is you might encounter a shift-reduced conflict. That means that in your canonical automaton, you encounter a state where you have a complete, a non-completed item and a completed item. So, these are states that we cannot really deal with LR0 as a concept. But yeah, there's ways what we can do. We have not still not looked at all the possibilities that we have. So, thinking back to our conceptual drawing with the conceptual derivation tree back in mind. If I try to visualize such a conflict, it would be like this. You had, for example, the situation where on the pushdown you had a T, and there's now several options what you could do. You could, for example, go the reduction from T to E. This would correspond to this branch. And the other one would be, well, you might also instead shift a star and all the components that you need to produce an F in the end and then go to T. But actually, that was not. There's only one valid way to do that. And this would be we have to do the one with the shifting. So why do we shift here? It's not so clear so far, but yeah, we can also find another place in this sequence of reductions that also supports the reduction of a T, and that is just one step further with this T. Once again, the pushdown looks like it did before. It also has a T, but in this case, we didn't go for shifting something and then producing a T. But in this case, what we did was we directly reduced to the E. So what's the difference between these two situations? So these two, if you see me switching these, the only thing that that actually could be seen from a parser would be the fractions over here. So it must be something to do with either the pushdown or the input. And yeah, you see, the thing that is different is the start of the input. So you have a star here. In this case, you have a plus. So might that have something to do with whether to reduce or not? And turns out that's already the right intention that you have here. The thing is, for example, in the first variant, what we wanted to do is we wanted the whole system to tell us to shift in order to get to the derivation from T. And in this case, what we found was we found the star in the input. So when is this? What is the actual conditions for the derivation tree to tell us that we have to go to the t part. Well, in this case, the thing that is interesting is the kind of right context of the t, meaning what comes after the t. That is what the input gives us. And this kind of right context is something that we can also try to localize in the rules. In the rules, we will find, for example, one place where we can actually see that in case that my t is followed by star, I will probably have this first variant, so going to t. Can also do the same one for the other reduction spot. There, the context of t was plus. So in the context of plus in the input, which is the production to choose for reduction? Well, the one that we had before was actually relying on a star coming directly after. So this one might not be the one that we want to have, but there's only one other occurrence of the T on the right-hand side. There's this one. And curiously, this one has no right context. There's nothing following on this side. So what would we assume for this one to have as a right context? Well, this is an occurrence of the T that is always happening when we came from E. So the right context of the T is in this case is all the right contexts of occurrences of the E, because this E might actually derive to a T. So we have to have a look at all the occurrences of T, of the E, to find the right contexts for T. And it actually turns out that E can happen here and here. So the right context of E is either the closing bracket or the plus symbol. And well, plus is a happy thing, because that's something that we have in input. So this is the indicator for the upper rule here, with this right hand side to be the one to choose. So that is also the one that will happen here, because we have found plus symbol in the input. Yes.
Is there a limit to how far back you can look up? For example, if you have some dummy production rules like A goes to B and B goes to C and C goes to D, and then you have the same rules.
You have to do the full closure.
Up until you get to somewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you think back to what we've done for LLK, that is something that we already know how to produce. We have a way of finding out these closures of things to follow. Yes?
And this won't eliminate all the undeterminism, right? I mean, not all grammars would be part of this one.
This one only takes into account the very next symbol. So there's still a lot of the parts of the derivation tree that you ignore in order to decide. So you're right, there might be still non-determinism when there's grammars that are actually dependent on the things that come further on. So this, it's just kind of delaying not taking in the whole input as guide, so to say. But turns out that this is already helping for certain grammars. You can now separate all the grammars that you have in classes that are whether they are compliant to an LR of fixed size k or k plus one or whatever. Yeah, whether they are doable with an LR one or an LR two or whatever. It's kind of similar to the LLK things, where you had LL1, LL2, and so on. Yeah. So the criterion would be in the derivation tree, you could decide by looking at if you have situations where you have same left-hand sides of these sentence forms, and if you only look at k, the k first symbols of the symbol of the terminals that come after these similar parts, the only way would be that, yeah, the whole computation so far is actually matching. That means that they these prefixes and these non-terminals must be the same. In these conditions, where all of these kind of positions in doubt can be decided this way, we will call the grammar an LRK grammar. So, what can we do in order to determine whether a grammar is an LRK grammar or not? Is we have to actually have a look at these rightmost derivations. We have to trace this kind of situations here with actual rules and actual symbols and identify the handles in there. These are the B's and their prefixes, and check whether by looking at most k symbols of the following terminal symbols, whether we can find a unique right-hand side of a production with which to reduce. So let's try that. For example, we have this grammar here. Yeah, what do we need to do? We need to come up with these derivations. First of all, this is one that is not LLK. Why is that? Well, you can have a look at this one. This is a kind of left recursive structure, and yeah, this won't be LLK for any K. But let's still have a look at whether it can be done with some LRK. So, and we have to trace all the different sentence forms that might be produced via rightmost derivations. So let's try that. I'd say, what is a valid rightmost derivation? Well, for once there's one going from S to B, from B to 1. So that is something that I can uniquely identify. This is the handle, so there's no disambiguity so far. Okay, another one would be 0. Well, 0, there's no prefix, there's no suffix. I can easily find that this one is the rule. So yeah, that's also fine. What is other rightmost derivations? Well, I have to have a look at these ones that come from B. So these will end up with, yeah, these will generate A, B, B, B. And yeah, in principle, all I can do with right most derivations in this case is do the recursions here. That will give me some power of A at the very beginning, but I still can when I need to localize a handle in that, this will be and oh wrong color sorry no. A N minus 1 A B B. Like, well, the handle in there is always this one. I don't even have to check for something that comes on the right. Okay. And what's something? What else can I produce? Well, there's also I can go the A part of the whole thing. That will lead to, yeah, a pretty similar situation, to the n minus 1, and then AB. And for this one, I can also clearly find the handle. So I didn't need to consider any thing from the input that would be over here somewhere. So in these cases, well, I didn't need any look ahead. So, well, that's all I can produce as sentence forms that will lead to, well, you see them mentioned once again. And yeah, I forgot those. But yeah, apart from that, I would say there's no need for anything that has to be read right of any handle. So I can assume that K is zero for LRK, and yeah, I can do this grammar with an LR zero parser. That's what I would do for this one. We can continue with another grammar. This one is clearly also not LLK for anything, because it's still this recursion. But yeah, I still need to have a look at all the things that I can produce with that. So yeah, what's possible here? I can produce AC. Yeah, that's by itself already a handle, so that's, yeah, I can decide this one so far without any problems. Then I can continue with ABBC. For this one, I can localize this part. If I recursively expand with the A, I would just create arbitrarily many Bs before terminating with a C, but still I can find that ABB is my handle without any touching anything from here. So yeah, I think that's all I can produce, except for the last thing. Last thing I can produce is A. Yeah, I have to go this one, and this is ABB BNC. In this case, I don't have a large A, but a small A. This is for me the indication that I'm in this alternative. So once again, without checking anything from here, or there, this is part of the handle, but yeah, there's nothing coming afterwards anymore. So I still didn't have to check any of the remaining input.
Zero,
yes.
But how do I if I pass now in A, B, and A, B, B, or A, B, whatever, and now I could actually reduce the first B already to an A.
Yes.
So then I just have to be left.
Yeah, but that is not a valid input. So you only have to check for valid inputs. So, yeah, but good questions. You only need to consider these that are actual derivations of the whole thing. So that's what this means. Okay. Yes. So far, it's not been so difficult. Difficult parts might turn up later on. I think someone in the past was asking about well, we did a lot of fuss on left recursion. What about right recursion in grammars? And yeah, let's have a look at right recursive grammar like this one here. So what does that do? Let's once again check our states. So what can we do here? We can, first of all, we can produce AC. Well, it's clear, it's the whole sentence form. What else can I produce? A, B, B, A, C. And this is something that I can probably do a few times. So I might up with n many. So and then the other thing that I can produce is the ones from before, and now I can have B over here. So where are the handles? Well, I did a little bit, yeah. Here is a handle, but here I have to draw it a little bit more convenient. This one. So, for example, for these two, can I differentiate them by only looking from the start? How many symbols after any of these handles do I have to look into the parts that come after the handle to make them unique? My thing is, this part is something that you have to, well, this part up to here, you have to take into account anyway. So the, well, it's not what I wanted. This one, you will have to read in anyway, but that's only a part of the left context of the alpha, so to say. So, that's okay. That's still something that does not cover any look ahead. Look ahead is the thing that I need to look at the right of the handles, meaning this part. So the actual problem has to do with the situation here. Too much. Sorry. Correct. The actual problem was that here in this point, I might also have tried to do the reduction with this alternative, but by considering one symbol to the right of my handle, which is this one and this one, I could actually make the difference between them, because all valid sentence forms that I can produce in this way are the way that if I need to reduce the single B as a right hand side, I will have a C following, and in this case I will have a B after my other B. So this is the amount of symbols that I need to check. this case I could do with only one. And that is also the number. Oh. That is also the constant that suffices for this example. This is the handle for this right-hand side, the BBA. But I needed to go through rightmost derivations, and that's something valid that I could produce. You mean why I didn't mark only the B in this one? Or
more like how I understood was that you would be looking at the second B?
At this one?
Yes. Which means that you'd be looking at something in the handler after the handler. That just seems confusing.
If you well, in fact, with this one, you wouldn't. Yeah, we would have kind of had to. You only got them in one step, so to say. You had always to the whole derivation. So you could not really end up in a state where to the right there is a non-terminal somewhere, because this can't be in your input. This is not what you. So this cannot be the right choice. This must be a complete handle, a larger handle than only this B, because there's already a large A that comes to the right of it. So it can't be the last part of your pushdown.
Okay.
Because if you stop with the red marker here, yeah, there's still a large AM that doesn't.
I'm just wondering if you would be looking then at the B or at the C in that one. So, what would be your lookup in this case to determine in which case you are in?
The look ahead I can always do, it must be constant things. So, what I started with is doing these rightmost derivations. With rightmost derivations, you end up with constants from the right. And I can also try to mark, for example, I also always have to mark from the right. So I might also do kind of this one. But there's no handle at all for that, so there's also no ambiguity here.
Okay. So
maybe you could do a small example with like two A's in it. So
with two A's?
Well, no, just so with two recursions or with one recursion.
Okay, that's well, they're hidden in this one, so it would be just A B B B B A C, something like this, and you go from the right, and yeah, that is a handle that you find.
And then you look at C to determine whether or not.
Yeah. Always look to the right of the handle that you found. The first, you mean on the last slide? This one. in this case, it's probably because I've done the I've done the derivation here from S to AC, and all the constants that I can have from the right are already finished with derivations. So this is something that is in, well, from the derivation side, it is in the output. From the parsing side, it is on the input already. So this is fixed and is to be seen as, for further derivations, this is already a fixed context. So the C will stay outside of my things. And, what I've do now is I do the derivations of this A, and this will lead to the BBA. And it's probably also answering where the point is where we have to split between the input look ahead and the handle. Yeah, so you have to look between derivation steps. Okay. Yeah. So next example. Fiddling around once again with the sequence of the A production. It's now BAB. And here, once again, we need to produce rightmost derivations, and to make it short, that is one of the derivations that can happen. And in this case, well, there's the one that will eventually produce B with this variant. So this is one decision that we have to do at some point. We have to decide at one point to reduce with only the single B instead of to reduce with this part. And in the situation that we have here now, I will produce with each of the recursions one times a B. And I can do that arbitrarily often, although I have to decide that I need to apply my single B reduction somewhere in the middle. And you see, I can do that arbitrarily often, and in order to determine when I have to reduce with my single B, I need to count this number and this number, because I need to see the C in order to know when to do the reduction. But with recursive derivations, I can enlarge this n to an amount where it hits every constant that I fixed beforehand for this LRK. So that is an example for a grammar which I cannot do with any of the LRKs. Yeah, but that is not a single step derivation. The only derivations that I do is with these B A B, and I cannot do the B to the N in one step. I cannot only do one, and I need to exactly see this right hand side on my pushdown, and I won't see it in this case. Well, I'll see is B to the N, B to the N. Once again, I could, if as a human, I can of course push everything onto the stack and then see, then now I have the C. Now I can find the middle point and start reducing. But with our automatic things, we always rely on the fact that we have input only so far, covering the alpha part, and at the first point where I might do a reduction, I can only go a limited number of symbols further in the input, and then I need to decide. Apart from that, I would already have parsed everything. Apart from that, I would already have parsed anything, and that was actually the purpose, the goal of doing anything. And I need more information. than only the beginning of things. So that's why it can't happen. Okay. But although there's examples that we cannot do with LLRK, it might turn out to be a lot of help because we consider more information for our input. So let's do a construction for that. So let's start probably with something that we can do easily, which is this LR1 thing, because we need to consider this first computations somehow. And for first one, we have a pretty nice computation. So yeah, we would introduce something which is called the LR1 item. And this LR1 item will help us in our piggybacking characteristic or canonical automaton in the sense that it carries with itself the right context for this item to be valid, which means the situations in which these are valid is a valid assumption for an appropriate LR1 item. So, yeah, the question is now, how do I come to these right contexts? What I do is I can create them while I create my characteristic automaton. How do I get them? For the start state, I'm quite sure what the right context must be. The right context must be the end of file. So that is what I enter here. Well, I use the epsilon once again as the empty string, but actually it would be end of file. It switches between different implementations of LR1 generators, but yeah, that's how you start. And there's several transitions that you can do, similar to the ones that we have had before in our characteristic LR0 automaton. There's the ones that do the shifting. For the shifting, the context in which this production was valid does not change. So what I do is I simply copy the right context over to the to my produced LR1 item. The other ones that we did so far were the ones that were mimicking the expansions, and the point where they had their handle was this non-terminal that came before the marker. And what we did was we introduced an epsilon transition to the expanded rule with a marker on the left-hand side. And now we need to come up with a context in which this expanded rule would be valid. And yeah, how do we get this one? We get this one. Well, actually, we started with expanding from this B. This B had a special context already. This context was everything that followed from this B. That's this B, this beta. In case that the beta was empty, or the beta was very short, or turning out to become epsilon, we also have the context in which the A was appearing. And this is something that we can read off here. So in order to get the new context, X prime, what we needed to do is we needed to combine the contexts beta and the old one X. That is just doing one concatenation on the first sets. So that's something that we can quite easily do. We just write the first of beta of this one, And in case that beta turned out to be epsilon, we add the context that we can read inside of the parent LR1 item. Apart from that, the whole construction is the same one that we had for the LR0 automaton. That's why we did the other one before. So, yeah. How do we progress? We once again make the whole system deterministic by doing the canonical automaton. In order to not have to do the characteristic one beforehand and then do the power set construction, we can similarly to the way that we did for the LR0 canonical automaton, we can create it directly. Once again, what we need to perform is a closure, an epsilon closure. That is the function that we've seen already. It's doing it's acting quite similar to the one that we've already seen. For each of the items that has the marker in front of a non-terminal, we also add the expansions production to our closure. The only thing that is new now is that we also have to compute first sets accordingly, the right context of these items. So with the right context X prime, what we needed to do is we needed to compute the one concatenation of the beta prime with the with X prime. And yeah, due to the fact that I used the notation with the star here, the closure of this these derivations, I also got some other symbols that came to the right of this, so yeah, I also needed to include them here. But conceptually, what I do is I just one concatenate the context with the context of the item in order to get my new context. Yeah, so that's all that I need to do. We can try that for an example. So what you see already drawn here is the construction as far as we know it from the LR0 construction. And now we can concentrate on the parts that are missing for the right context. So let's probably start with our initial state. It has a right context. What is the right context of the start production? The starting item?
End of file.
End of file, yes. So in this case, epsilon. Yeah. Now I needed to transfer or to create a right context for this item. This is one that I got from this one here. So, what do I need to do? I need to compute the one concatenation of the right context of this symbol E. This is pretty easy because there is none. And concatenate it with the right context of the whole item, which is epsilon. Also pretty easy, so I can just write epsilon here. That's nice, because that's pretty much the same thing as I can do for this one. I can also write epsilon here. Yeah, what else do I need to check? I could reach all the E productions also from this place, because I could also unfold or derive from this E. This now makes a difference, because here I have another right context. That's something that I didn't have before. And for the LR0 automaton, this did not matter. For this one, we just had to unfold and add it once again the expansions for E. Here, it makes a difference because the E is now occurring in a different context. So now what I also need to compute is the one concatenation of the first one of plus T and the context of later one, which, well, the plus is already a terminal, so I'm already done with that. I just need to add plus also as write context, and same goes for the one over here because this is also an E. Okay, so fine so far. But now there's the T that I have to consider. For the T, I also need to have a write context. What is the write context of T? Mm-hmm. Epsilon plus. And because you already saw that there's the T occurring this, yeah, correct? There's also star. So it's epsilon plus and star. Very nice. Good. So next I have to do is create the context from the right context for F. So for this one, I just copy epsilon plus star plus star. But yeah. Is it all? The opening brace. Why the opening brace? We have to be careful. You only open one of the new productions for. You want to have the bracket here. Actually, exactly. The only thing that matters for you is the place where you expanded from. To reach this, F goes to mark a bracket, and so the bracket itself, that's something that I do via transitions, these ones. So I don't need to cover them with write context. That is only the case when I unfold from this E. So, but it's actually a good question because it shows the difference when I have to include the following symbol or not. Question was whether I need to consider this one. Ah. Do I need to consider this bracket as being right context for E? And in principle, yes, but what also is needed for that is you need to have the marker in front of the E that is followed by the symbol. So only when you unfold, only when you derive from this non-terminal, you also copy its right context. And in this case, the E is not unfolded in there. That's what I was actually hoping for when I was asking, are we done yet? But we are done here because there's no marker in front of the E. But it might end when we had the marker here. We might have to reconsider all the items that we had before, and would have to add them and recursively bring them to all the other items. So yeah, it's a recursive algorithm. That's a closure, so to say, and yeah, that's what's needed here. Okay, and same goes for the others here. So let's check whether we got them right. But I think, yeah, looks nice. Yeah, the other ones, I think, would be a good idea to do at home, because that's quite bothersome to do all these computations, and you have to recompute the right context sets whenever you encounter somewhere deeper that there's a marker in front of something special. And yeah, turns out that this is actually happening somewhere else. Well, this is still the same kind of state amount that we had for the LR0 automaton. The new ones are the ones with the primes. That these are these ones here. These ones result from actually these situations where you have separation of states because they have different look-ahead sets. So earlier on, when we had this LR0 canonical automaton, we had to check whether we have already produced one of these states. And for checking similarity of two states, we could use only the set of items without any write context. But now for this LR1 automaton, in order to get a similar state as one that we had before, we also have to take in account whether we have the similar look-aheads for each of these items. And that's why there are now more states involved. And it's a good thing to have that here, because that means that our automaton is more detailed and gives us more information. Although it also means that I need more computational overhead to create this automaton. And I get a larger automaton, by the way. And yeah, this... I think it's the Q5. Is it probably? Let us find one that is that's having this behavior. So there was the Q5. It's this one here. That had that started with the marker in front of the E, and the other ones are just canonically produced by derivations. And it started with the context epsilon plus times, or epsilon plus star. And we find a similar one, which is this Q5 prime, that is also computed from this, but it has bracket plus times as starting context. So these are actually different. This one has its context the end of file plus and star. And this one is the same set of productions or items, but in a different context. So there's the actual difference coming into play. And yeah, this. Let's come to the end of this construction. We will get almost as many states as we had beforehand, additionally to the ones we already have. And that's all because of these contexts. Well, you don't have to do them manually, because you have these generator things. But it's important to know that because these generators yield errors sometimes when they are not able to produce for the grammar that you provided an LR1 compatible lookup table and all that. And in these cases, it yields the actually it yields the LR1 items that these states are made from. So you need to tell where there are differences and what is the meaning of these things. So that's why I show you these things. So these might have similar items, but different contexts. And this helps in keeping apart places where you do reductions and places where you do shifts in a certain way, because now you, in case where you have several LR1 items in your state, for example, here, you can now tell by looking in your input by one symbol whether you find, for example, in this case, end of file or plus, or in the case below, the one concatenation of times and one concatenation of this star and whatever this F gives and epsilon plus star, and this will yield actually star. So in these two cases, you can differentiate between these two items by checking whether it has a star. Then the second one is the one that is relevant for you, and this one would mean do a shift because it's not a complete item. Or in case you have an end of file or a plus, in this case, the upper one will be the one that is responsible for this situation, which would mean reduce. And in this way, you can make your automaton more deterministic for grammars that you couldn't parse before. There are still some that might not be parsable with LR1, but it's a pretty large number that you can do in this way. And most of the ones that you know that are major programming languages, you can do with LR1 parsing. So what do you do to finish off to an LR1 parser? You need to have the transition function of your canonical LR1 automaton. You need to store it in a table to use it afterwards in the LR1 parser. This one is built exactly similar to the one that was the LR0 parser, but now it has this go to and action tables, and this action is just looking into the state of the LR1 canonical automaton and matches with the input and tells you afterwards which of the items was the one that was that's relevant for you, and then either tells you whether you want to do a shift or a reduction with the rule S prime and variant 0, for example. So that is what you can statically compute from your automaton, and what you can then use in your LR1 parser to decide what you want to do. And yeah, that's actually what you need to do for the whole thing. There still might be reduce conflicts or shift reduce conflicts that we had before, but these are caused by the fact that you would need a longer look ahead. So these would be grammars that or items that are not suited for LR1 parsing, and similarly you can call them LRK unsuited if they would need K plus one or even further look ahead, but these are the borders of what you can do with LRK. So in practice, LRK turns out to be quite expensive because it's with larger look ahead you get larger amounts of state, and even with LR2 and LR3 you get a real explosion of states because it's an exponential enlargement of the state space that you do when you need to combine as many characters that you have with each of the ones that you already have. So that's creating an exponential blow up in your state set. So there's special subclasses that you can do, but I will skip them here because they're just differing in the way that the context is actually handled and produced, and this tries to tighten the space of states that you can produce for your LRK items. The important thing is doing the summary for the whole thing. What we've seen is for parsing, we have the situation that we need to do more than regular languages. We have seen LL as principle. LL is a hierarchy of things that that are strictly more powerful than before if you add more look ahead, but still for deterministically parsable languages this does not suffice. There are still languages that you can't do with LLK, so we came up with another principle, which was this LR0. LR0 has some intersections with regular languages. Well, it covers the regular languages, but has only intersections with the LLK hierarchy. Still is something that's not sufficient for deterministic languages. There are special cases, SLA, SLR, and LALKR grammars and parsers. Well, that's something that is not so interesting for us. The most interesting part for us, which is quite astonishing, I find, is that with LR1, you can parse any deterministic language. We've seen examples where there are grammars that are not doable with LR1, but you can transform them in a way that they still detect or generate the same language as an LR1 grammar would do. Well, the transformations of these grammars will make LR1 compliant grammars, and the language will not change for these things. So with LR1, you can pretty much parse any deterministic language that you come up with. So that's quite nice to have. Yeah, so that's all. For a summary for the lexical and parse and semantical analysis, no, lexical and syntactical analysis, let's recapture a little bit what we had. There was the concept of generation for us. We had talked about regular expressions, how to convert them to finite automata, how to get from finite automata to scanners with this by need construction and this greedy matching. We've talked about syntactical analysis with top-down analysis. For this, we needed to compute look-ahead sets. We have talked about how to do these computations in an efficient way. Then we have talked about how to come from item pushdown automata to LL1 parsers. That's one of the methods you should keep in mind. We've talked about bottom-up syntax analysis. We've talked about characteristic and canonical automata. We've talked about shift-reduce parsers and how to make LR1 parsers from them. And I think that was all from my part. I'm now done for this semester. Next lesson, you will have Axel Simon here, who will tell you first about semantic analysis and then going over to code generation and optimization. If you're interested in topics about syntactical or lexical analysis, come to me. I have tasks for that, for bachelor's or master's thesis or any other works. If you like formal languages and doing practical things with formal languages, this is something that might be right for you. So that's all for today. Thank you very much for your attention, and I wish you good luck in your exam.